As the November election rockets toward us like a rocket that will explode and scatter our bodies and possibly even our souls over a gore-spattered kill zone that used to be America until it was hit by a rocket, it's time for us to ask ourselves, what are the choices we should be thinking about as we writhe in a strangling paroxysm of mutual hatred and rage until we're hit by the November election as if it were a rocket? First, there's the candidates themselves. On one side, we have Joe Biden. And hey, let's say something positive about our president. I mean, sure, he's a lifeless body that's been horrifically reanimated for political gain, but at least he doesn't eat people's brains, so it's better than having an actual zombie in the White House. Although, that might be kind of cool, too, like if he was shuffling aimlessly around the Rose Garden, muttering incoherently with his mouth hanging open and his eyes glazed. He's doing that already, so you get all the great zombie effects without the actual eating of brains. So, hooray for Joe Biden. On the other side, you have Donald Trump. And of course, there are plenty of positive things to say about Donald Trump. We know that because he said most of them, which proves he's still alive, so at least he's not Joe Biden. Then there's the issues. And yes, I don't care what they are either, but let's take a look anyway. Number one, there's abortion. Joe Biden is a devout Catholic, so of course he believes in a blood-drenched mass slaughter of millions of innocent babies, up to and including the moment of their birth, after which they can be mutilated into flesh costumes of the opposite sex to appease the insane academic theories of sexual perverts, because Joe Biden is just so devout. Donald Trump believes that abortion should be left to the will of the people. So it could be like a TV game show where you hold up a baby and people give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And if it's thumbs down, too bad for the baby, but he gets the board game version to take home as a consolation prize. Then there's the war in the Middle East. For Joe Biden, this is a matter of principle. And as soon as his base tells him what his principles are, he will stand squarely with Israel until that upsets the bloodthirsty pro-terrorist leftists who want to destroy Israel as a prelude to destroying America. Then he'll stand squarely with them. Donald Trump, on the other hand, is a friend to Israel. He just doesn't want to say so too loudly because that might upset the part of his base that's a group of bloodthirsty pro-terrorist rightists who want to destroy Israel because that's where the Jews are. And what good have Jews ever done besides developing aspirin, curing polio, building the bomb that defeated the Japanese in World War II, and creating the American movie industry, and musical comedy, and quantum science? And okay, they also make great bespoke suits and wrote the Bible. But screw that. Groypers know how to type in all caps. And of course, there's the economy. Joe Biden believes he's done a great job with the economy because he's a shuffling, muttering, zombie-like creature who doesn't know what the hell's going on, which is actually kind of comical until you have to spend your rent money to buy eggs. Donald Trump actually built a great economy during his first term, but then he let it die when Anthony Fauci ran through the Oval Office with his hair on fire as he screamed, "Everyone's going to die from COVID unless we kill the economy." So, if Trump wins re-election, my recommendation is that he reverse the process and set Fauci on fire first. Then he can build the economy and also cook up some s'mores, which are awfully good. So, that's my incisive look at the candidates and issues in the upcoming election. You might want to print this out and take it with you into the voting booth so when the rocket hits, it won't come as a complete surprise. Trigger warning, I'm Andrew Klavan. This is The Andrew Klavan Show. We are back laughing our way through the end of days. This would be an excellent time to subscribe to the Andrew Klavan YouTube channel, where you will get exclusive content dropped down your chimney, wrapped in pornography so people don't realize it's right-wing content and be upset, like you're corrupting your own mind. You'll see everything we got there and on the audio feed and on Daily Wire Plus. On Daily Wire Plus, we will put up everything, including the interviews. Last week, we had a great interview with Peter Schweizer about Chinese blood money coming into our politics. This week, we have Mary Harrington, one of the smartest ladies. I don't know where to put her politically, but she's just a really interesting, she calls herself a reactionary feminist, and I really, really like her. Also, leave a comment. And if the comment is, you know, thought-provoking in that sort of way that, like, you know, Mein Kampf is or something like that, hey, we'll just read it on the air because we can't sink any lower than we already have. My favorite comment this week comes from Carl Weeb, maybe 3806. Excellent show, educational, thought-provoking, and concise. It's amazing what Klavan is capable of with a full 4 hours of sleep. Keep it up, good sir. Absolutely true. And last night I got about 2 hours of sleep, so this show should be about half as good. However, we will get to today's episode, Video Game America. So, O.J. Simpson died yesterday, as I'm recording this. He died, I think it was cancer that killed him, though cancer says it'll spend the rest of its life looking for the real killer. The New York Times says O.J. was a football star until a murder case, this is a real quote, quote unquote, ruined his world. The murder case ruined his world. So with respect for that tragedy of O.J.'s ruined world, I'd like to honor O.J.'s memory with a minute of Norm Macdonald.
According to retailers, the most popular Halloween mask this year is O.J. Simpson. And the most popular Halloween greeting is, I'll kill you and that guy who's bringing over your glasses, or treat. And the Pope came out with a book this week, which contains a series of essays examining faith and morality in today's secular world and the changing role of the Catholic Church as it approaches the 21st century. The book is entitled, God Himself Told Me That O.J. is Guilty. In his book, O.J. Simpson says that he would have taken a bullet or stood in front of a train for Nicole. Man, I'm going to tell you, that is some bad luck when the one guy who would have died for you kills you. That's probably... You don't get worse luck than that.
Now, Norm was eventually fired from Saturday Night Live for those jokes because the NBC bosses were playing golf with O.J. They liked O.J. and they didn't like what he was saying. This was obviously before NBC covered up the Harvey Weinstein scandal in service to their Hollywood bosses at Universal. But this is actually what I want to talk about today, not how corrupt NBC is because I haven't got time. But I want to talk about the way truth gets silenced and what it means for conservatism at this important moment of transition. Chapter one, audience capture captures audience. Now, I haven't really been covering the war in the Middle East a lot, partly because it's just not on my mind that much, but also my focus here is America and the nexus of culture and politics. But part of that nexus, part of the place where those two things meet, is the rise of Jew hatred on both the left and right. Obviously, Israel suffered a horrific, one of the most horrific terrorist attacks in recent history that I can think of, killed 1,200 people, raped people, burned children, killed parents in front of their children, killed children in front of their parents. Just, you know, savagery. And everybody seems to feel, not everybody, but the people, the Jew haters on the left and the right both seem to feel that somehow that's Israel's fault and they have no right to retaliate. I personally, completely on Israel's side, I think they should finish the job and wipe Hamas off the face of the earth and in their usual way, taking care to kill as few civilians as is humanly possible in this tight area where the terrorists hide behind they're not just the hostages, some of them American hostages. I think there were eight originally, now they're saying three of them are dead, but also hide behind their own people, you know, so to make sure that anybody who tries to attack them will kill their own people. And then they go to the reliably Jew-hating left in the media, and they say, oh, look, you know, poor Palestinians. And so that's the way I feel about that. But that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about anti-Semitism again. I've talked about it before, but it's getting worse. And I've always called it the devil's flagpole. And what I mean by that is it may not be the thing that causes evil. People may not do evil in the name of anti-Semitism, but wherever true Jew hatred pops up, you know that something has gone terribly wrong. You know that evil is on the rise in that place. So now we have it on the left and we have it on the right. It's more important on the left because they have more power in the culture and more power in politics than the right does, but it's still very ugly on the right and it's poisoning. For instance, X is very hard to go on because there's so many of these groypers, as they call them there. But there's the reason I feel that Jew hatred is always a sign that evil is rising is it comes from basically a great story about John Wayne, the greatest movie actor of all time. John Wayne was on his deathbed. This is a story from Scott Eyman's biography, John Wayne, The Life and Legend, just a great biography. And he talks about Wayne lying on his deathbed and people are coming to visit him. All his friends are coming to visit him. And one group comes in and with them is a guy named Al, who's Jewish. And Wayne was always being accused of bigotry, anti-Semitism. He was always being accused of this stuff. And of course, he had plenty of Jewish friends. And this guy came in and Wayne's son said to him, oh, you know, the Duke didn't want to see you because Al is a Jew. And Wayne smiled and, you know, he's dying and he looked up at heaven. He pointed at heaven. And he said, it's the other Jew I don't want to see. And, you know, because he's saying that we get our ideas, a funny joke, because it's funny because it's true that we get our idea of God from the Jews through Jesus, a Jew, right? And I feel that this is what why anti-Semitism is always a sign of evil, because the Jew haters think that they hate the Jew in front of them, but it's the other Jew they really hate. It's that God who's telling them to love. It's that God who's telling them to be kind and charitable to the poor, to treat people, even your enemies, with love. That's the God that's the Jew they really hate. So whenever you see this rise up, you know that you're looking at evil. So this week there was a pro-Hamas rally in Dearborn, Michigan. This is Rashid Tlaib's congressional district. And here's just a splice of that rally from the guys at Memory TV. This is cut to.
Malcolm X said, and I quote, "We live in one of the rottenest countries that has ever existed on this earth. It's not Genocide Joe that has to go. It's the entire system that has to go. Any system that would allow such atrocities and such devilry to happen and would support it, such a system does not deserve to exist on God's earth."
Dearborn, Michigan, gang. This is Dearborn, Michigan. They're screaming that what they were screaming in Arabic was death to America, death to America. And the guy giving the speech basically says this country that he's living in, that he's been brought into, that he's obviously, you know, being taken care of in, is the rottenest country on earth. He's quoting Malcolm X, and it does not deserve to exist. So they're not kidding when they say death to America. They are saying because America is an ally of Israel, and America is an ally of Israel because Israel is a democratic, free country, the only one in the area that is fair to all the different minorities who live there, including Muslims and Christians. But they're the bad guys here, not the people who came and raped women until the women were dead and burned babies up. They're not the bad guys. I don't know why you would even think that. The bad guys must be America. And Rashida Tlaib, Hillary Vaughn from Fox News, good for her, tried to corner Tlaib, but she was too slippery. Snakes are like that. And Hillary Vaughn tried to get her to denounce these cries in her district of death to America. Here's that scene.
At a rally in your district, people were chanting death to America. Do you condemn?
I do not talk to Fox News.
But do you condemn chants of death to America?
I don't talk to people that use racist tropes.
Why can't you just say whether or not you condemn people chanting death to America? Why are you afraid to talk to Fox?
Fox News is not, listen, using racist tropes towards my community is what Fox News is about, and I don't talk to Fox News.
It's death to America racist? Is chanting death to America racist?
I'm talking about your guys' racist tropes. You know, you guys know exactly what you do. I know you're Islamophobic, but you guys got to go deal with it on your own self. You're not going to use me.
So you're smart. I don't have to tell you what she's doing there. She's demonizing Fox to get out of answering the question of whether she will condemn people chanting death to Israel, death to America, because that's why they want Israel dead. They want the West dead, and Israel is just the smallest version of the West they can get their hands on. It's the one place where they know they can get sympathy because people are anti-Semitic, so they know they can build up sympathy in the anti-Semitic press, the leftist press, and so they want to destroy Israel first, but it's only as a prelude to destroying us, and you can tell that from the speeches. And you can see she's demonizing Fox News in order to get out of answering the question. You can see that because it's Rashida Tlaib who's on the other side. Can you see it when it's done by Tucker Carlson, who used to be at least something like a conservative, a pro-American conservative? He put out an anti-American, pro-Hamas, anti-Israel video this week that was so ugly. And listen, since Tucker left Fox, I've been pointing out that he's going down a dark road. He did that interview with Andrew Tate where he let Tate just smooth talk him out of the fact that Tate is a working pimp, an admitted pimp, a guy who is on video beating a woman with a belt on video saying, oh, you know, women love to be beaten with belts. You know, he's just I don't know. I don't. If I have to tell you that he's a bad guy, you probably are listening to the wrong show. Hopefully, if you're listening to the show, you know that a guy who treats women like that is not your pal. He had an interview with Donald Trump where Donald Trump did all the talking. I felt like Melania, like sitting around listening to this guy, thinking, does he ever stop? You know, it's like, but he didn't question him, not one hard question of a presidential candidate. He did the same thing with Vladimir Putin, where Vladimir Putin snowballed him. And people on the right were saying, isn't Vladimir Putin smart? By talking about, you know, in 900, we had a relationship with Ukraine, so we get a right to invade them. I mean, Vladimir Putin is a KGB, ex-KGB guy who used to do the things that KGB people did, which was torture and kill people. He's killing people now. But for Tucker, it was just so wonderful that in Putin's Russia, they had carts in the groceries. I mean, whoever saw a cart in an American grocery? No, but Vladimir Putin reminded me of guys during the communist days. I remember talking to a communist saying, we have jazz. I said, dude, we have jazz. You know, you're just smuggling our records in. So now he puts out this, and this is the first minute of this video he put out about Israel.
A consistent but almost never noted theme of American foreign policy is that it is always the Christians who suffer. When there's a war abroad that the United States is funding, it is Christians who tend to die disproportionately. And this goes back a long way, 60 years, really, to Vietnam, where Catholics in that country were massacred. But it's accelerated. So, for example, during the more than a decade the U.S. government spent occupying Iraq, the ancient Christian community of Iraq was completely devastated. 9 out of 10 of them are no longer there. They're gone. That was an effect of our foreign policy, but it was almost never noted in the United States and almost never, ever even mentioned by Christian clergy in this country, many of whom supported that war and that occupation. Why is that? Maybe because it wasn't. Virtually no one in any American church said anything when Christians were killed in Syria, very often by Islamic extremists paid for by the United States.
This is an amazing piece of distortion and dishonesty, okay? I mean, firstly, he talks about Vietnam. It was the Viet Cong, the communist Viet Cong, who slaughtered Catholics again and again and again. One of their commanders said the Catholics are considered particular enemies of ours. Of course they are, because they believe in God, which you can't do when you're a communist. Is he trying to suggest that if we hadn't been in Vietnam, the communists would not have been oppressing Catholics? Because if that's true, then how does he explain the fact that when Pol Pot went in after the Democrats surrendered in Vietnam, when Pol Pot went into Cambodia, he wiped out 50%, 48.4% or something like that, of the Catholic community in Cambodia as he was slaughtering 2 million people. The communists do not need America to start killing Christians. That is part of what they do. And every other incident he talks about in this video and what you heard and in other things in Syria and Iraq, it was the Islamists who were killing the Christians and killing off the Christian people. The one thing he mentions where at least Israel was involved was in bombing Gaza, an Orthodox church was destroyed, and he makes it sound like they were attacking Christians, but that's not true. They were attacking a nearby site, and people were hiding in the church. And I don't know what religion the people hiding in the church were, but he makes it sound like Israel was particularly going after this church, which is absolutely nonsense, since Israel takes care of the churches in its country, keeps them open to Christians, which they are never would be under in a Muslim country. He mentions an incident in a church in Israel where a terrorist came in. He says a priest was killed with an American weapon. Doesn't mention the fact that the American weapon was being wielded by an Islamist extremist. He doesn't even say that. He blames Israel for Christians being chased out of Bethlehem. Bethlehem is under the authority of the Palestinians, is run by the Palestinian Authority. The Jews and the Israelis had nothing to do with that. And then he keeps saying no one talks about this, which is just untrue. Christians, pastors are continually trying to bring to the attention of the media, who I will admit is anti-God and anti-Christian, anti-truth and everything else, but Christians are continually trying to bring the oppression of Christians in other countries. Christians are the most oppressed religion on earth. They are the most oppressed religion on earth. Not here. Here it's the Jews. But they are the most oppressed religion on earth. And Christians are constantly trying to bring that to the media and talking about it. And finally, he says amazingly this. This is cut 5.
How are the Christians doing in that region, in Gaza, the West Bank, and in Israel proper? We almost never hear from them, and so we thought it would be interesting and may be edifying to hear from one right now.
So how are the Christians doing in Israel? It would be interesting. We never hear from them. So there are 180,000 Christians who live with full rights in peace in Israel, as Muslims too have full rights and live in peace in Israel, able to visit their shrines and their holy places, which are protected by Israeli troops. Instead, he interviews this guy, Munther Isaac, who is a Christian Palestinian who gave a sermon the day after 1,200 men, women, children, babies were burned, shot, and raped to death, in which Munther basically saluted the terrorists. He said there was a scene of Israeli youth who were celebrating a party since the dawn, and suddenly they saw militants and fled. Maybe you saw them running in the desert in an empty area. This scene turned my attention to the strength of the contradiction. Youth come at dawn, party next to the borders. Within the borders, people live in the most extreme conditions of oppression and poverty, and one is not interested in the other. In other words, they deserved it. He obviously supports Hamas. So why is he Tucker always does these things as if they were the most innocent, obvious thing in the world. Why is it innocent, obvious of 180,000 Christians in Israel to interview this one guy whom we know to be a terrorist sympathizer? And of course, when you object to this, me or anyone else, me, a devout Christian of Jewish birth, proudly of Jewish birth and Jewish descent, but a devout Christian, no matter who it is, all you hear is Jew, 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 Christ is king, you dirty Jew, and how could Christ and his king be anti-Semitic, you Jew? But they're not doing the same thing that Rashida Tlaib was doing to that reporter. They're not demonizing the person asking the question to hide the fact that this is despicable. It's anti-American. Remember, same thing as in Dearborn. It is not just anti-Israel. It is anti-Israel by way of being anti-American. Now, listen, I'm not a perfect person. But if I woke up in bed with Rashida Tlaib, I would change my lifestyle. If I looked over in bed and I was lying next to Rashida Tlaib, I would say, whatever I was drinking last night, I'm never touching that stuff again. Whatever I put up my nose, whatever made me crazy enough to climb into bed with that lady, I'm not doing it anymore. And Tucker Carlson should take the same advice because he's saying the exact same thing as she is. Now, to be honest with you, my interest is not in the gripers. I mean, it's not in even Tucker Carlson. It's in the people on our side, the right, the conservatives, the people who believe in a free America, a constitutional America, an America that pays its debts, that can do what it needs to do and keep its people free, which is what I care about. Why aren't they talking about this? Why isn't everybody standing up to this everywhere? And the answer is, and you know, one thing I love about the internet, it invents clever names for everything, is audience capture. The people who listen to Tucker and the people who hate the Jews on the right are actually not as vast as they are on the left. The left has really been taken over by them because they have bad philosophies, and bad philosophies lead to evil, and evil is always marked by anti-Semitism because anti-Semitism is the devil's flagpole. So that's why that happens on the left so much. But on the right, there's not that many of them, but there are enough that they give you some audience. And, you know, I hope most of us start doing things like this because we have some truth that we want to speak. But as you speak the truth, if you're good at it, if people are interested in what you have to say, you make some money, you get some fame, you get some attention, you get some comfortable, you know, some comforts in life, you don't want to give that up. You're afraid to lose that audience, unless you're Norm MacDonald, because he's Norm MacDonald, or me, because I'm on a mission from God, right? But other than that, that's called audience capture. You don't want to offend your audience. And part of the audience is into this stuff. Part of the audience thinks Tucker is absolute, oh my goodness, Putin, what a great guy. Oh my goodness, why should anybody interrupt Trump and ask him a question just because he's running for president? Yes, yes, what is wrong with the way these Israelis treat this? You know, there's a sizable minority of people who believe that. And people on the right who have power, who don't want to give up the money, don't want to give up the wealth, don't want to give up the audience, they're captured by those people. Now, the thing is, and they don't want to speak up. They don't want to speak up and say it. Now, the thing is, when you turn on a guy who is captured by his audience, you get captured too, because now you have a person who's supposed to be on your side. And people who are on your side, what do? They tell you the truth. They tell you what they think. We don't always get everything right. But if I care about my audience, I tell them the truth. I take the hit because I don't want you to take the hit of getting lied to. That's why I don't get captured by my audience, because I want my audience to hear, the audience is willing to hear will hear. The audience is not willing to hear, yeah, they got to leave and I'm going to lose people. That's fine. That's okay. As long as I still tell the truth. You know, the thing is, you do not want to wind up with the devil's flag in your hands, because that's who really does the capturing in a way. The love of money, the love of fame, the love of comfort, right? That's how you get captured. And it's like John Wayne said, these guys who hate the Jews, left and right, they say they hate the Jews, but it's only the big Jew they really hate, the God of love. And you can tell by the way they speak and the look in their eye and the hatred in their hearts, you can tell. And we cannot let the right wing, the conservative movement, the freedom movement, the Constitution movement, we cannot let that movement get captured by the devil. Chapter 2, Arizona of Interest. I finally got to watch the film Zone of Interest. It came on Max, I guess, so I finally got to stream it. Excellent, excellent movie. I know this guy, Jonathan Glazer, who wrote and directed it, made that stupid Oscar speech where he disavowed his Jewishness because he was comparing the Jews to the Nazis, which is, of course, a famous trope. The Nazis murder Jews, and now they're going to claim that the Jews are the Nazis. But talent is blind. Talent is blind. It doesn't care. It even comes to people like me. I mean, that's how blind talent is. It doesn't care where it rests. It has rested on this guy. This is based on Martin Amis' novel. Martin Amis, an excellent writer. I really liked it. And it's based on the story of a real guy, Rudolf Hess, and his wife, Hedvig, who helped run the slaughter of 6 million Jews, the absolute stone-cold murder of women, babies, children, the technical gassing. This is what Hess did. And so the movie is about him. It's a very quiet, very restrained movie. It's a work of art. It really is a beautiful picture. Beautiful may not be the right word because it's so depressing. It'll suck all the joy out of your life for hours afterwards, so you might not. My wife wouldn't watch it. But Hess and his wife, Hedvig, who is played by Sandra Hüller, who may be the greatest actress alive. She was also in Anatomy of a Fall. Anyway, they're running the death camp. You can see it over the walls of their house, but they're living in this beautiful house. We never go inside the death camp. We just live in this beautiful house with their children and the garden and the fact that Mrs. Haas Hedvig is so happy to have all this wealth. And, you know, sometimes they give her stuff from the dead people. They steal the Jewish person's furs before they kill them or some dresses, and she gets to give those to the servants. And so she, you know, she's a woman from not a very high standing. Her mother was a cleaning lady, and so now she's really landed, she's made it, and she doesn't want to lose this perch outside of Auschwitz. And I'm watching this, and I have to tell you, I was a little bit convicted by it. It was about the fact that they are ignoring the greatest atrocity, one of the greatest atrocities in human history, because they're living their lives. They're making money. Everything's great. You know, this is good. We live in this beautiful house. And yeah, you can sort of hear people screaming in the background, but you know, so what? And it brought to mind the fact I recently also rewatched Gone with the Wind. Great, great movie. One of the greatest movies in American history. Maybe one of the top five movies in American history. And one of my favorites. And you know, it's about the Civil War in the South. But you know, the movie is awash from the first frame with what's called the lost cause mythology, the idea that somehow there was something noble about the Confederacy and it was a lost cause, and that's sad. And it starts with this very elegiac, you know, kind of mournful, scroll where it says, this was the last time, the old South, this was the last time we ever saw that wonderful world of knights and their ladies fair, of masters and slaves. I thought, whoa, back up, back up. I like the knights and the ladies fair, but do we have to like the slaves? And it's just filled with this nonsense about the slaves are stupid and happy, but they're kind of basically happy as slaves. They're fine with it. And at one point, Ashley, Leslie Howard, says, well, we treated our slaves well. You know, it's not like exploiting workers. We treated our slaves well. Just total falsehood. But the funny thing about it is by buying into the lie that this was not a grave evil, and it was a grave evil, even when it was, it was just as wrong then as it is now. I understand that people didn't know it was, maybe didn't register how wrong it was, but still, it was just as wrong then as it was now. That doesn't change. But by lying about it in the film, it actually has this weird thing where it gives you the feeling of what it was like to be there, because your civilization is being destroyed, right? And no matter what's happening in your civilization, if you live there and you're doing well and things are going well, whether you're, you know, the people at Tara in Gone with the Wind or the people outside of Auschwitz in Zone of Interest, you know, you're, that's what you're thinking about. You're thinking about your life, your kids, your, you know, your salary and all this stuff. And I felt, I have to be honest with you, a bit of conviction, a bit of guilt about this, because we are living in this country where close to a million babies are being aborted every single year. And, you know, we're not ignoring it. I speak up about it. I hope you speak up about it. But still, it's something that's going on all the time. And you do have to take care of your children. And, you know, it's not the Holocaust. I understand that. It's different. But it is a Holocaust. And it is evil. And it is bad. And there's no way to excuse it. There's no way to get out. So on the same day, right after I went outside and watched the eclipse, and that was kind of fun. And then I read Pope Francis's declaration called Dignitas Infinita. And then right after that, I heard Trump's statement on abortion within minutes of one another. And my weird reaction to this is I thought the Pope was morally correct, but politically foolish. And I know I checked with Catholic people to find out what they were saying about the popes, because they had problems with it. And that's fine. I'm not denying their problems with it. But his basic idea was that every human person possesses a dignity that is inalienably grounded in his being, because he's made in the image of God. And that dignity prevails beyond every circumstance or situation. So if you're a baby and you don't yet have your full capacities, you're an unborn child, and you don't have your full capacities, you still have the right to life. That's one of the things he said. And then I listened to Donald Trump's statement on abortion. And with Trump, I agreed with Trump politically, but morally, it was inexcusable. So here's what Trump said. Let's play the clip from Trump.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be. At the end of the day, this is all about the will of the people. You must follow your heart or, in many cases, your religion or your faith.
Well, so why do I say I agree? Let's start with this. Why do I say I agree with him politically? Because we're losing politically. Whenever we try to ban abortion or go too far trying to ban abortion, not only do we lose elections, but we lose the people. Their opinions are turning, becoming more in favor of abortion. So let's say you're fighting, and this is a grave evil, we have to stop it, but let's say you're fighting a grave evil like the Nazis, you're in war with the Nazis. And I say, well, this is a grave evil, so I'm going to take my stick and charge at that tank. You say, no, you're going to have to wait years until you build up an army that can invade France. You're going to have to fight them in the beaches. You're going to have to fight them in the cities. You're going to have to fight them slow by slow. You're going to have to use strategy when you want to just charge. You're going to have to do what you do, and it's going to take time. That's the way I feel about this, right? Politically, we are not winning. We are losing. We have to change our strategy. And remember, politics is just one tool. It's one tool we have. Another tool is the culture. And what we have to do is create a culture that is conducive to people understand. You know, people always ask me why I won't call abortion murder. They think I'm dithering. I call it homicide, but I won't call it murder. It's the same reason I don't condemn George Washington for holding slaves. When the culture bathes you in this idea that you can't even see that you're doing evil. And the funny thing about George Washington, an absolute hero, a man of virtue, a man who loved liberty, he could not see that his slaves wanted to be free because he was bathed in that culture, right? And that's why, you know, I'm not cutting him slack for what he was doing. I'm cutting him slack for his mindset. And to commit murder, for murder to be murder, you have to understand that you're committing murder, right? If I think I'm killing a dragon because I'm nuts and I kill some guy, that's not murder. That's, you're actually not guilty by reason of insanity. And that this is a kind of insanity that we're in. So it's homicide, but I call it murder because many of the people who are doing it are not bad people. They just are awash in this corrupt society, namely our society. Our society is no longer a moral and religious society. It is corrupt and it is doing this evil thing. So I think we have to change our political goal to convincing people, to making people see that this is something that has to go. In the meantime, though, you know, Arizona, for instance, just restored an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions. So now Republicans are in position, not wanting to lose elections, of trying to fight that decision. Now, the decision, people are saying they banned all abortions. No, they just said this law has not been repealed. So now you have this weird thing where Republicans who are supposed to be pro-life are fighting to get there to be abortion in Arizona because they don't want to be destroyed in the next election, as they may well be if that doesn't happen. The Alabama Supreme Court ruled that IVF was killing children. As you know, in IVF, you inseminate, you fertilize numerous eggs, and then the one that doesn't become a baby, they get frozen or they get thrown out. And so people are against that. You can do it with just one egg, but it's much more expensive. And so, you know, Trump is saying, we've got to restore that. We've got to restore your right to IVF. And so we have this weird, weird thing where the people who are supposed to be leading the pro-life movement, who are supposed to be speaking up for pro-life, are speaking up for death. And that can't be our strategy. It has to be a different strategy where what we say is, look, you know, we think this is wrong. We understand we can't win this. And we understand that people want this. We're going to give you what you want, but please listen to why we're saying what we're saying. And we know the press is going to fight us every step of the way. We know they're going to lie about us. We know they're going to make us, but we have to at least speak up. And this is a failure on Trump's point. He's never able to do that. He only pretends, you know, he doesn't, he's, you know, it's almost kind of lovable about him that he just wants to fix things. He's good at fixing things. And that's the way he looks at everything, as a practical thing. But you do have to have some moral leadership as well. Now, you know, this is a difficult time because we went down this road a long, long time. We went down the Roe v. Wade road a long, long time, and it corrupted an entire generation, maybe two. And the road up is just as long, but it's up, so it's steeper. And we're going to have to climb it step by step by step. It's going to be slow going, but we have to keep going, and we have to remember what we stand for and fight for what we stand for when we can and do what we have to where we must. And, I'm sorry. I know we like Trump. I want Trump to win, but this was not the way he should have put this forward. I think it's a survival thing. And I think it is important that he survives because he knows this is true. And he says this in his video. If he loses, we lose everything. These people are ready to just slaughter every baby in sight and mutilate the ones that survive. Long climb, upward climb, step by step. We got to do it. Oh, go to Hillsdale Ad. I love these guys. If you're a few years or even decades out of school and wondering, what did I even learn and what was the point? First of all, you're not alone, and it's not too late. Hillsdale College is offering more than 40 free online courses. Hillsdale College's online courses allow you to learn about the works of C.S. Lewis, the rise and fall of the Roman Republic, and the history of the ancient Christian church, all from the comfort of your home. If you're unsure where to start, check out American Citizenship and Its Decline with Victor Davis Hanson. In this 8-lecture course, VDH explores the history of citizenship in the West and its current threats. Threats like the erosion of the middle class, the disappearance of our borders, the growth of an unaccountable deep state, and the rise of globalist organizations. The course is self-paced, so you can start whenever and wherever you like. Start your free American Citizenship and Its Decline course with Victor Davis Hanson today. I taught at Hillsdale for a couple of weeks. It's a great place. The teachers are great. So go to hillsdale.edu/Klavan to enroll. No cost, and it's easy to get started. That's hillsdale.edu/Klavan to enroll. hillsdale.edu/Klavan. And even before you learn anything at Hillsdale, you have to learn, how do you spell Klavan? It's K-L-A-V-A-N. No E's. I just make it look this easy.
There are no E's in Klavan.
Chapter 3, You're Being Gamed. Now, the theme that I'm talking about here are the things that prevent us from learning the truth. And the reason this is important is because, as I've said repeatedly, I feel this is the end of something. It's the end of an old conservatism. It's the end of an old leftism. And new forms are going to go forward, and we want to know what we're fighting for. And I'm fighting for the same thing I was always fighting for, which is freedom. I want people to be free. In order for people to be free, power centers have to be limited. They have to be played off each other, and the government especially, because once the government has power, it's impossible to get it away without violence, and I don't want that. So I want the government to be limited. I want there to be more constitutional government, where if the government is not given power by the Constitution, it does not have that power. So everywhere we're awash in lies. Everywhere we're awash in lies, where people are afraid to speak because their audience captured, where people are speak but they're telling lies. And of course, the culture, which is one of my main focuses, is just, I watch the three-body problem. I made a joke about it on X. My joke about the three-body problem was that it was fantasy and science fiction. The science fiction was interstellar travel. The fantasy was that women are physicists and men are supportive. And it was just filled with these women, these determined, grim-faced women physicists who are the greatest physicists in the country. And the men are all these soft, flawed, slightly neurotic, dependent, supportive people. And I just thought, give me, I'm not watching the rest of this, give me a freaking break, okay? Because at the same time, I'm reading this Elon Musk biography, Walter Jacobson. It's really entertaining. Jeremy recommended it to me, and it's really interesting. But at one point, Musk and Jeff Bezos are racing to get rockets into space. There's two billionaires. There's the toys they're playing with. They want to get rockets into space. And one of Bezos' rockets fails to go into orbit, and Musk tweets to him, "I guess you couldn't get it up in orbit." And I thought, yes, when I say the future is male, that's why. That's how progress is made, by two little childish guys with zillions of dollars, you know, in this dick measuring contest, shooting these phallic rockets into space. That's how progress is made. It's not made by actresses playing determined physicists who are female, because let's face it, that's not the way that's going to go. I'm not saying it never happens. Feminists have taught us to believe that if you can find one example, everybody keeps saying, what about Madame Curie? Yes, there's a Madame Curie, and feminists teach us that that's a good way of thinking, because they're feminists, so they don't know how to think. But just because there is an exception doesn't mean that's the rule. The rule is it's going to be rich, smart guys who basically want to prove they're bigger men than the guy next to them. So there was one thing on the three-body problem I really liked, which was the song from Lana Del Rey called Video Games. Here's just a snippet of it. Really interesting modern song. You know, I don't like modern music, but this song I found interesting. Cut one.
I say you're the bestest, leaning for a big kiss, put his favorite perfume on, go play a video game. It's you, it's you, it's all for you, everything I do, I tell you all the time. Heaven is a place on earth with you, tell me all the things you wanna do.
So it was really interesting about the song. And this is me reading it, and I'm not an expert on modern music, so maybe it's a bad read, but this is the way I heard the song, listened to it a couple of times because I thought it was interesting, was that the verses are very dead. The music is very deadpan, almost monotonal, and describes this kind of unfortunate relationship where he's really not paying attention to her. He's playing his video games. You know, they're going out and getting drunk, and she says, "You like a bad girl," so she's becoming a bad girl. And then you have the chorus, which is this meltingly romantic song, and the music changes and everything. It kind of swells, and she says, "I'm doing everything for you. Just, you know, sort of tell me who you want me to be. I'll play." You know, she has her favorite dress on, his favorite perfume on, and he just wants to play his video games, you know, and he's kind of lost in this world. And he wants bad girls, she'll be a bad girl. If he wanted something else, she would be that. And you know, I was thinking about this because I love video games and I do play video games, but they're actually being misused to do exactly this, to take us out of life, which is what she represents in this. She loves him. She wants to be in a relationship with him. She wants to make love to him. She wants to give him what he wants. And he's living in this kind of narcissistic, emotional inner world. And the thing about video, I reviewed a book once. I hate writing book reviews because I hate writing bad reviews. And this was a bad review. I always felt guilty about it because the author got ill shortly thereafter. But it was a book called Reality is Broken by Jane McGonigal. I think it was out 2011. And what she was saying was basically reality is not as good as video games, so we need to make reality more like video games. This was it was called gamification. It was a big Silicon Valley idea in the 2010s and 2011s and all this, because there was some research that showed that using motivations from games could be used to get people to do things in reality. In fact, here's the report from the women who did the research, cut seven.
You see, in every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap, the job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree, it's very clear to see.
So that was Mary Poppins in 1964. 50 years later, Silicon Valley caught on with this brilliant idea. And the thing is, they're using it to control people and to change people's minds in ways that are damaging to the mind. I don't want to pick on video games because it's not the game's fault. It's the people's fault, right? Of course, it's not the game's fault. But, you know, in this book by Jane McGonigal, Reality is Broken, she talked about this contest online for Halo, a terrific game that I remember playing. And they were having this alien war, and people were getting kills. You know, they were scoring the kills. And everybody was very exciting. And she said, Halo is only a game, but just because the kills don't have value doesn't mean they don't have meaning. They gave meaning to people. Meaning, she says, is the feeling that we're part of something bigger than ourselves. It's the belief that our actions matter beyond our own individual lives. And I wrote in my review, no, actually, that's not what meaning is at all. Meaning is when you have those feelings and beliefs and they refer to something that is true, right? And when you're playing a video game, that is not victory, that is not risk, that is not danger, it's not heroism. It's just make-believe, and that can be fun, and that can be actually refreshing. But here's the thing. When I was a kid, when I shouldn't say a kid, I was already older when I was in my 30s when video games came out, but when I was playing the early video games, if you lost in those video games, you went back like a long way. You had to go back to the start of that episode or whatever it was. And so being killed was really bad. You really felt bad about it. Now, because people don't like that, they've made everything easy. And so you get this feeling, I'm playing a game now, Final Fantasy 612, whatever it is, and you die and you go back to like a minute before. There's no risk in dying. And they're using those little bursts of success that you get you to do stuff, to go on social media, to want likes. Remember Facebook, that when they make Facebook, they said, we wanted to colonize your mind for as much as possible. They now have this Chinese app, and the Chinese are just trying to kill us with these apps. This one is Temu. Apparently they use the same kind of thing. If you buy enough stuff, you get a prize. If you buy enough stuff, it puts a leaf on a tree, so they're controlling you in that way. And apparently older people love to move. They're buying all this stuff. And so people are becoming risk-averse because they can have the experience of heroism without even swinging on a rope tied to a tree, you know, without even doing the things that kids used to do. And I don't want to sound like, oh, when I was a boy, sure, you know, there are all problems at all times, but people are, as we know, just so stuck on these screens that they are becoming risk averse. This is where I think these red pill weenies come from. These people are like, oh, I can't get married because I might get divorced and the girls might like not like me. You know, that was always true. I mean, it was always a risk. You always, when you ask a woman to dance, the most frightening thing that ever happens to you in your entire life is when you're 12 or whatever it is, and you have to ask a girl to dance for the first time, and she might say no. She might laugh at you behind your back. You know, it's a horrible thing, and all of us, everybody, gets rejected, girls too. That's the risk of life. That's the risk of life and love. And by making everything easy and everything fair and everything nice, this is another way of the system, the systems of the world conspiring against the truth. You know, in life, there are three ways to handle the fact that life is not what it should be. Life is bad. It's not what it should be. One is pretending it is and can be made to be. And I've seen so many people destroy themselves trying to pretend that life was going to be fair once they got through with it. The left does it all the time, but individuals do it too. They say, well, it should be this way, and so it is this way, and it's just not, and they just, you know, their careers go down the drain because they don't do the things they have to do. The other thing is the people who are destroyed by the fact that reality is in fact broken by just kowtowing to that, by bowing to it. That's what audience capture is. You say, well, I'll lose my audience and I need my audience, so I'm just going to say whatever my audience wants. And then you get destroyed in a different way. Maybe you make $1 zillion, but you're still nobody. You're nothing once you do that. You just have lost your way. You've lost everything that made you worthwhile as a person. The person who survives and thrives is the person who says, look, I am going to do the best I can do and be the best I can do at every single situation, understanding that because reality is broken, I'm going to have to pay a price. I'm going to have to pay a price. And I have to decide whether that price is worth it every single time. Is it worth it to have more babies die because I feel better going out and saying the world should be this way, so I'm going to go and fight the abortion fight no matter, even if I lose every election and more babies die, I don't care. That's one way of doing it. The other way is saying, you know, like, oh yeah, well, we can kill babies. It'll be up to the people whether we kill babies or not. Or are you going to say, okay, I'm going to take some hits, but I'm going to try and win. And winning is going to take time, and winning is going to take strategy, and it's going to eat me up that this is happening every day, and I'm living a good life while babies are being torn to pieces, but I'm going to fight the strategy the way it has to be fought, bit by bit. And that is the thing that we are losing. And because we are living in a world so surrounded with media, and all of that media is an emanation of the world, and the world does everything it can to kill, to crucify the truth. Final chapter, a theory of now. Now, I want to run a theory by you, and I'm not sure yet whether this is completely true, but I think a lot of it is true, and I think it's worth discussing, even at this point, even if I change it as I go forward and see more things. I believe something is happening right before our eyes. I've said before that I think that both Joe Biden and Donald Trump are the end of something, not the beginning of something. They may herald something new, but something is going to have to happen because, you know, leftism is a total failure and conservatism has failed to beat it back. And so we're going to have to find new ways into the future, no matter who we are. And everything is changing, too. Things are changing so fast technologically, not just with AI, but with the stuff that Musk is doing at Neuralink. It's all going to be very different, very fast. And so people who are stuck in the trying to bring back the 50s or stuck in old arguments are really going to be left behind. And one thing I've been, there's a story I've been following, but I haven't had a chance to cover it. No one's covered it, honestly, was this proxy fight at Disney, where this activist investor Nelson Peltz teamed up with former Marvel CEO Ike Perlmutter to try and get two seats on Bob Iger's Disney board. And everyone covered this as if it were an economic event, as if all Peltz was saying was, you know, we need to give dividends or some kind of different economic thing. But really, it was a cultural thing. He was saying, turn off the woke BS, you know, and which is killing Disney. It's destroying Disney. And Iger won. And then they started covering it and saying, well, Iger won. Every board member got 90% of the vote, as if Peltz had made no effect. But that's not true. Peltz only went after two seats. And of those seats, he really got 30% of the vote and more. And so really, it was a rebuke to Iger. And I don't know whether it's going to make any difference. But we are at a period of major turning in the culture, which, remember, the culture is down, you know, politics is downstream from the culture. So stuff that's happening in the culture is going to matter later. When I talked last week about the fact that intellectuals are turning toward God, that's going to flow down. You're going to see that's coming. That revolution is coming. That revival is coming. You believe me, it will. There's going to try and stop it, but it's on its way. Angel Studios, I've talked about them, the Sound of Freedom, the fact that they went around the Hollywood distribution system, which is going to be out of date momentarily because I'll be able to make a movie on my computer with AI and put it out there on Substack and reach you as many people as will come and talk to me. You know, Barry Weiss, who fired from the New York Times for not hating Trump as repeatedly as they do. She built the Free Press on Substack. Now she's doing great. She's an actual news source. And Barry, I love Barry. She's, you know, we don't agree on everything, but that doesn't matter. You know, she's a good person. She's an honest person. She's covering things honestly over there. Spencer and I are doing our New Jerusalem Substack, where we're talking about God in a very high level way, with not just banging our Bibles and, you know, shaking our fists at people who do things differently. We're talking about the meaning of God and what it means to live a godly life. And I think it's a really high level conversation. It's not, literally not happening anywhere else. That's the thing on the newjerusalem.substack.com. You will not hear anywhere else. Now, what I'm telling you is that the left culture is collapsing. It is collapsing, it is being eaten out from under. And that's why they want to destroy Elon Musk. They want to just silence people. That's why they're making all these big noises about the reset. That's why they're spying on people. You know, I love this fact that Christopher Wray comes before Congress and says, oh, you know, terrorism is terrible. You have to give us more FISA. I thought, wait a minute, you spied on Trump with FISA. You guys lied about Russian collusion. You knew you were lying and you tried to destroy a man's presidency because you didn't agree with him, you scum. And now you're telling us we need to give you more tools? Well, yeah, in some ways they need the tools, but we better make sure these guys do not misuse that stuff anymore. We've got to hamstring them and fire them. That's the main thing we've got to do with them. You know, so partly it's because of this media that is spread and we can see everything, and partly it's because the left sucks and everything they touch turns to crap and everything they do is a lie. And so they're starting to lose. And you know what? You know what part of it is? Part of it is the Daily Wire. I know some people think of us as like the sort of the establishment, but I don't think that's true. It's not true on the show, I'll tell you that. I'm nobody's establishment. I'm out here on my own saying things that only I am thinking about. But still, you know, this is the Daily Wire, because of Jeremy, because of Ben, because of the things we do here, has opened up a lot of fields of information and fields of culture and ways of doing things that other people, I hope, will take advantage. I think that Glenn Beck is making a film now, too. I think that's great. You know, I want more people. I want the competition. I want it all to happen. And now, you know, I told you when I started, I'm a conservative because I'm a liberal. And what I mean by that is a classical liberal, nothing like a leftist whatsoever. But I want people to be free. I want you to be able to do what you want to do. And I understand that the thing about freedom is it requires moral life. It requires religious life. It requires association, freedom of association, which I think civil rights law has undermined. You know, you don't like me because where I come from. You don't like me because of the color of my skin. That's fine. You don't have to associate with me. You should not have laws that force people to be with people they don't want to be with. I'm sorry. I hate bigotry. I think it's against God. I think it's against the image of God. But still, I think people should be able to live in whatever neighborhood they want and do whatever they want to do. So we have this moment when the right is actually rising. And one of the reasons I want people to be free and I want power to be limited is power corrupts everybody. And I've said this repeatedly from the moment I had this podcast. I have said to you, the people on the left are not evil. The people on the left have so much power that it has corrupted them. It has made the worst people rise to the fore. And the point I'm trying to get to is this. The right is rising. The right culture is rising. Freedom culture is rising. I don't think hate culture is rising, but I think the hate people, the bad people, are now riding on top of that. They are piggybacking on the work that people like the Daily Wire and others, Angel Studios, I want to give credit to anybody I can, Chris Rufo, great people, Babylon Bee, I want to give them credit to Glenn, all of them. I want to give credit to all these people who have done wonderful work, and now the bad guys are going to piggyback on that to push themselves into the movement. And you know what? It doesn't, if there's a boot on your neck, it doesn't matter if it's the left boot or the right boot. It's still oppression. If we want freedom, if we want the Constitution, if we want an America, it's going to be the globe because it's a global world, in the future that looks like the founding, that has some bearing on the founding, that is the founding transformed into the 21st century, we got to get these guys out of the movement. William F. Buckley did it. He kicked the anti-Semites and the haters out of the conservative movement, and that's how we got to Reagan, because Reagan was not a hateful man. Reagan was a strong man, but he wasn't a mean or hateful person. If we want that to happen again, that amazing success that gave us 25 years of great America after the 70s, when we thought the 70s was the end of America, it was just like now, we thought it was the end. Reagan came along, Giuliani came along, and it wasn't the end. That happened to some degree because of culture makers like William F. Buckley, and the first thing they did was expel these people, and we got to do it again. We got to do it again. We know who they are. In one way, because of their Jew hatred, it's the devil's flagpole, because we know they think they hate the Jew in front of them, but we know they hate that other Jew, that one John Wayne was talking about, that one who preaches love, who preaches freedom, that one who looks a whole lot like Jesus Christ. All right, if you would like to make sure that never happens again, send in your clapbacks to clavenclapbacks@dailywire.com. Both Klavan and clapbacks are spelled with a K, and neither has an E in it. It's K-L-A-V-A-N, clavenclapbacks@dailywire.com. Whether you agree with me or whether you're wrong, send in the comments. We'd like to hear from you. And you might want to subscribe to the show and become a member. Go to dailywire.com/subscribe and use code Klavan at checkout for 2 months free on all annual plans, or else at this very moment, you will be plunged into Klavanlessness, the darkness of Klavanlessness, which is many S's, but also screaming and wailing and gnashing of teeth, because we're going over now to member block.